Welcome to Literary Arts, the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from the first 30 years of literary arts in Portland. We bring you Barry Lopez this time. It's a talk from Portland Arts and Lectures in 1992. Lopez was born on the East Coast and grew up in California before moving to Oregon in 1968. Since then, he has become one of our state's most iconic writers and activists. He is the author of Arctic Dreams, for which he received the National Book Award, of Wolves and Men, a National Book Award finalist, and 8 works of fiction, including Light Action in the Caribbean, Field Notes, and Resistance. Lopez's essays are collected in 2 books, Crossing Open Ground and About This Life. He contributes regularly to Harper's, Granta, and the Paris Review, among others. His most recent books are Home Ground, Language for an American Landscape, and Outside. Lopez is a recipient of several awards, including the Award in Literature from the American Academy of Arts and Letters, a Guggenheim, a Lannan Fellowship, a National Science Foundation Fellowship, and Pushcart Prizes in both fiction and nonfiction. Join me for Barry Lopez here on Literary Arts, the Archive Project.
I understand sometimes there's a problem with the sound system. I have several things to say before I begin. I don't want to put too fine a point on this, but it is an extraordinary pleasure to be here in this series, and for once in my life to look out on people who live down the road from me instead of at the other end of the country or something. I feel tonight that I'd like to share a lot of what I have to say as though I were in my home, which of course I am. I'd like to thank, first of all, the staff of the Portland Arts and Lecture Series, in particular Julie Mancini and Megan McMorrin and Donna Drummond, and also Regis McKennan, Pacific University, and the First Interstate Bank. And as unorthodox as this may be, because I know he's here, I'd like to take the opportunity to thank Paul Pinterich for what he has done in recent years for writers in the Pacific Northwest. It has been my privilege to know writers older than I am who've spent their whole professional lives in the West and who grew up here and who have had to suffer the condescension of people from other cities who write what most of us read about literature. I think of Wallace Stegner, for example, a man of inestimable value in our culture, whose work is not as well known as it should be, and it would be better known, and he would be more on the minds of most of us and our children, to good end, if he lived in New York instead of in Palo Alto. And I think Paul Pinterich and the Oregonian have done more, at least from what I see in traveling the country and reading other newspapers, to expose and celebrate the work being done in the Pacific Northwest by a group of writers than most newspapers do in other parts of the country. So I would just like to thank him on behalf of all of us. I'd like to say some things this evening about writers and about writing and about natural history. And I'd like to say a few things about the national debt, too, but I'm not a political writer. I also will probably say what seem to me some radical things tonight. When I think of radical thought, I realize most people think of this as not radical at all, but it does seem radical to me because it seems disrespectful. And I during the course of my remarks, will make some strong statements, and I hope that they're taken, for God's sake, not as dogma, but as things shared of an evening in a church. When I was traveling up north for a period of years working on what eventually became Arctic Dreams, I stumbled, as do all people of my culture, with another language. And the only way, actually, I ever got any sense of what Eskimo language was all about was by using white friends who were somewhat conversant with Eskimos and using them as intermediaries. And occasionally I would discover a word that spoke volumes to me, and in the way of all travelers, I would find just the right word to serve me and my purposes in somebody else's tongue rather than my own, which was to be expected, but always an embarrassment. I always wonder, why don't we have this word, you know? Why don't we have it in English? And a word that I discovered in Baffin Island, which is in Inuktitut, or Eastern Arctic Eskimo dialect word, the word is Isumutak. You could translate it as storyteller. The way I actually ended up translating it was, I think, more in keeping with the way that the people who spoke in that language would have translated it. And they translated it as the person who creates the atmosphere in which wisdom reveals itself. I prefer the definition to the definitions that my own culture provides for a storyteller or a writer, because it takes the burden of wisdom off of the writer, where it does not properly belong, and places it with the story. I think whether you're of an academic turn of mind or just an ordinary person like myself, when you really begin to work with story, you see that it is infinitely complex. The more simple it becomes, the more complex it really is revealed to be. So you'd have to be a consummate fool to say that you had the definitive interpretation of any bloody thing, let alone a story. I mean, that we say this all the time, the definitive work on the polar bear, or the definitive work on man, or the definitive work on, you know, I mean, these are, even children know this is, there's irony here somewhere. The child grasps that, I know they do. One of the reasons that I prefer this word, too, is that it, by taking the burden of responsibility for wisdom off the writer's shoulders, the writer is placed back properly where he or she belongs, which is a member of the community with predilection toward narrative. And if you're blessed, some sense of putting things together in such a way that they reflect an order that people brighter than yourself can say, yes, this is a proper reflection of the world in which I live, which is possibly more complex than the writer's world. You get rid of this silly business of celebrities, which is a terrible, destructive thing at the moment in this country. I see manuscripts that come across my desk for review or comment or something like that, and I remember getting a manuscript one time in which the editor said, this person is the next John McPhee, or the next Orr. You know, it's either God the Father or God the Son. She wasn't quite sure. This is the next John McPhee or the next Annie Dillard. And I wrote her back and I said, ordinarily I would return the manuscript having read it and say, thank you very much for the opportunity to read this. I did. I didn't find it so strong. I didn't find feelings of mine so strong that I would want to comment. But I'm going to say something else, and that is that you are to do a disservice to this young man by saying he's another Annie Dillard or another John McPhee. He is who he is. He is who he is. We don't need another John McPhee or another Annie Dillard, and we don't need to make these kinds of alleys down which we force personality. And there's something more insidious about it as well, and that is that a person who's 25 has probably not matured into the kind of vision that distinguishes Annie Dillard's work, and certainly hasn't spent enough time in front of a typewriter to develop the technical virtuoso skills of John McPhee. And to tell a person that, and to build that up in their mind when they're susceptible at the age of 25, is to risk destroying somebody that society might at one turn or another need. So it was a strongly worded letter, and I told her that those people who make mockery of publishing in the United States and the kinds of takeovers that have occurred in the publishing industry in the last few years, this is the fuel that feeds them. What they see here is the intention to market a product, not to show respect for the work of an individual mind, and to make clear the point that whether it serves 500 minds well, or it's one of those extraordinary things that serves 20,000 minds well, publishing is not a business of trying to serve the most minds. It is a business of trying to take the best of what we are capable of making clear and giving it to as many people as have need of it or sense that in it they find a reflection of the order that they're trying to establish in the world for themselves. And to take a person, well, I've made my point, but this is what happens when you begin this business of celebrities. The writer does not have really a chance to serve the community because it's turned into a thing and made to seem what he or she really is not. It's been my experience in the past 4 or 5 years that the most striking minds I now meet tend to be in the provinces, in little towns, in Montana or in Oregon or in Florida or in upstate New York or Vermont or someplace like that. And in one way or another, the conversation turns to this business of getting out of the places that manufacture and use celebrities because they're destructive to your work. I find that among painters, I find it among sculptors and dancers and choreographers and of writers. For some reason, we're supposed to feel that one day we might measure up in the West or in the Southwest or some other part of the country. We might measure up against standards established by other sections of the country. Well, this is ridiculous, of course. Other sections of the country take their cues from Europe. And this is a section of the country that takes many of its cues, both in business and in the arts, from Japan. It's silly to ask a certain part of the country to measure up to the standards of another. What we should celebrate is the difference in the different parts of the countries, because in that we at least say we're a range of different minds. We're not all interested in the same books and the same ideas. So I don't like this business of celebrity, and I think it's destructive for all of us, whether it concerns individuals or states. The writer's obligation is really to be in service to the community, and as long as you're in service to the community, then you should be allowed to stay around. Which is, you know, there's an interesting, another aspect of this business of storytellers among Native peoples. In my experience, at least, you are a storyteller not as long as you want the job. You're a storyteller as long as the stories that you tell work. And when they no longer work, even if you want to go on telling them, no one's going to listen. That would be wonderful if all things were like that. Sort of wreak havoc with the civil service system. But, you know, but wouldn't it be wonderful if a person could only have the job as long as the community knew that he did it well, and as soon as the community decided that he didn't do it well and the stories were not healing or helping, then you couldn't be a storyteller anymore, even if everything you did had been on the bestseller list once upon a time. You know, I think that in telling a story, one of the things that a writer is trying to do is to evoke or create a universe outside the self. That's one of the things that story does, and I select to talk about tonight because whenever I brood on this experiment in personal freedom that the United States has devoted itself to, it's coming apart at the seams a little bit. You don't need psychiatrists or economists or anyone else to tell us that things aren't working with brilliance, and they're not working smoothly. And part of it has to do with this confoundment we have, this internal development of the self at the expense of the community. It's not to say that it's a bad thing. It's to say that it bears thinking about what the self is and how much of life is devoted to an elucidation of the self as opposed to a support of one's family or community. Another way to get at this is to understand, for example, there's this. When I was traveling up north, I used to ask Eskimo people all the time, "What did they think that it meant to have wealth, to be wealthy, to be well off?" And one of the things that they often said was to have a family. And by that, they did not mean monogamy and stasis and some kind of mindless devotion to nuclear family or something like that. What they meant was a context in which one can love and be loved, and once one can experience the reciprocity of love. And that is as distinct from the preoccupation with the self. I think one of the most refreshing things about being with Native people and being in their landscape, not only their physical landscape, but their metaphysical landscape, is that there's not a lot of room for the person who wants to just focus on himself or herself. They don't look at that as a very healthy thing to do. And many of us know that it's not in our society or are at a loss sometimes to figure out how to get around it. So I think of this evening of story as one of those ways in which we find a way out of the self, a way out back into the universe. There is a word that Japanese use, some Japanese writers use, to define part of the task of writing. The word is kotodama. And what it means is the soul in the words, the part of the words that is spiritual, I guess. And they look at the work of writers as being in service to this principle of kotodama, or simply devoting one's life to the elucidation, well, not exactly, I guess, elucidation, but the support of the principle, living a life in support of the spiritual content of words, recognizing that there is a moral dimension, for example, to language, which seems to be lost on anyone living within 10 or 15 miles of the Potomac. Kotodama also means, I think, the preservation of what is finally irretrievable in the word, the mystery inside the word being a symbol of one sort or another. There is something that it stands for, and what it stands for cannot be articulated. What language does is collapse experience into symbols. That's, I guess, an esoteric definition of what it does, but it's an important one to keep in mind because we're all at various points, no matter how eloquent we might be, frustrated at the failure of language to encompass the experience of life. When you read something, I think, that is very powerful, the reason it's powerful is because of what you bring to it and what exists between you and what's written on the page. I remember trying to explain to somebody once that if you are involved in an experience as a writer and you try to recreate that experience for the reader and in hopes that the reader would feel some of the exhilaration or some of the horror or some of the excitement that was yours in that moment, that you're trying to create a language that will create the context in which the reader can blossom. It's not a matter of your doing entirely. You hope to trigger something that lies beyond language, the story within the story, perhaps. I was, for the past couple of months, have been working with a composer on another project, and one of the pieces of music in this theatrical project, which is us two, we're working on stage together, is a story about the wind. And in it, the violin, there are these passages in which the violin makes these incredibly beautiful series of harmonics and overtones. So we were having dinner one night, and we were talking about, I couldn't read sheet music from, you know, any more than I could read nuclear physics texts or something. Asked him about harmonics and overtones, and he explained to me that the way the music is made is that the finger never touches anything but the string. It doesn't come all the way down against the violin itself, and so what is created is never, a basic note is never created. You're only working with the harmonics. And so he and I were talking about collaboration, and I said, you know, what would be really interesting sometime is to try to discover a language to work with these harmonics that you're writing. And what we'd have to do is work only with the connotations of the word rather than the basic note, which is the denotation of the word. So we had this wonderful dinner conversation about working with language as though it only had connotation and had no denotation. It's one of those things you love to do, you know, because the mind loves this kind of stuff, and you have to rein it in and turn it into something practical and make it work on the stage. But for a couple of hours, it was pretty, it was a lot of whitewater. It was really exciting. Another way that I try to think about story and what story does, and by story, I don't mean... I don't mean to make a distinction between fiction and nonfiction. The distinction between fiction and nonfiction is a real one for me because I'm part of my of this culture, and I think I know when I'm writing that I work in different ways in different places. And it's clear to me when I'm working on a piece of fiction and on a piece of nonfiction. I'm not interested in a game in which they become confused at all. But I prefer a distinction that is again made by storytellers among Eskimo people, which is to distinguish not between fiction and nonfiction, but between the inauthentic and the authentic. The inauthentic being a story composed in some way of some kind of lie, I guess. Some speaking without authority or something like that. But the distinction between the inauthentic and the authentic seems to me a more profitable distinction to be making in the written language than between fiction and nonfiction, because the issue is always confused about the truth. You know, I don't know why this is, but it's apparently not, I always forget whether it's nonfiction or fiction that tells the truth. So it's why I write both, you know, in the hope that somewhere along the line I'll hit the right note. But a way to get at this, what happens between a reader and the piece that's called a story, which for me is either fiction or nonfiction, is to talk about what I call the exterior and the interior landscapes. The exterior landscape is the landscape not only of the city, but the places outside the city, and perhaps more easily graspable because it seems at first to be simpler. Those landscapes that you would find on the far side of Mount Hood or down where I live along the Mackenzie River, or if you're really interested in simplifying it, on the ice in Antarctica or in Baffin Island, wherever one would go. And what you see, first of all, are obvious things. You see the line and color and shape of the land. You see the way the land stands against the colors of the sky at certain periods of the year. You get a feeling for the chronology of the winds and how they move through their cycle in a year, their erratic and lovely behavior that's never quite able to pin down what the wind is up to. It's such an amorphous beast. Beast in the respectful sense. All of those things that are going on in the land that are discernible, we eventually end up talking about. But many things that go on in the landscape are not only not discernible, ineffable, but they're things that we really prefer not to define. They're kind of an emotion, the threads of our emotional attachment to place, and they don't bear much refinement before they collapse. They're so delicate. Those elements, the very subtle elements of the exterior landscape, are becoming apparent to us because of the refinement in Western science, the ability of ecologists to deal at micro and macro levels. We're able to pull some of this stuff up. But still, the landscape is fundamentally a mystery. We can sort of work around the edge and say this is a predator-prey relationship. These are the colors that one would expect to find in Baffin Island in July. These are the kinds of birds that would be expected to turn up in Sovey Island at this part of, you know, that kind of information. And as a kind of analog to that, I think of an interior landscape which is as complex and in the end as fundamentally mysterious. And the way I have come to think of story is as the relationship between those two landscapes. So if a writer recreates some part of the exterior landscape, either of the city or the countryside or whatever it might be, and puts the pieces together in certain ways, then a reader will be physically affected by the story. I mean, a reader who is in sympathy with the story, which is neither good nor bad. I mean, some stories work with certain readers, not with others, and I'm sure you know what I mean. It is inevitable in human life, with the principle is expressed in the second law of thermodynamics, but there is this principle of sort of winding down to nothing. And it happens to all of us, and we all have our ways, we have our coded language about going on vacation. Actually, this is parenthetical, but such a marvelous idea, I have to share it. Do you know those little buttons on turkeys that pop out when the turkey's done? This guy told me once that his wish was that people would have these things on their foreheads And that when it was time for them just to go on vacation, this thing would pop out. So then everybody would know, and you'd be under a cultural indictment to get out of the office or out of the family or whatever it was. But when we go on sojourns, on vacations or something, and have some kind of interaction with landscape, I think a similar thing happens. Many of us come back and say that we had a terrific time on this river or cross-country skiing or whatever it would be. And what is going on, I think, in that situation also goes on in literature, and that the story acts as a thread that connects the exterior landscape to that interior landscape. And when that interior landscape is disheveled, falling apart, in disarray, it can be put back together by a good story. I know this, I would say I know this in my guts as a reader, that I can read a story and feel a sense of energy and refinement and a sense of propriety and purpose and proportion in the world again when I put that story down in a simple assertion of the rightness of life and some vague notion of what my part in it is. That is a therapeutic value of literature, and I think of it often in terms of these exterior and interior landscapes. Again, because part of what you're trying to do as a reader, or writer rather, is respect the mystery of the exterior landscape. You're never going to get it all. And also be respectful of the reader's interior landscape, about which you can never be presumptuous. There will always be a reader who is infinitely more informed than you are as a writer, and able to discern and also articulate what it is that you might have done as a writer. And again, that's this business of isumatak. The obligation is to create the atmosphere in which wisdom will reveal itself. I have one poem that I think of that for me in a very succinct way ties these two ideas together, the interior and the exterior landscape, is a poem by a 12th century Japanese writer named Saijo. And the poem goes like this, if I don't drop a word. On a mountain stream, a mandarin duck, made single by loss of its mate, now floats quietly over ripples. A frame of mind I know. This is a marvelous ability to see something in the landscape and to see immediately the metaphorical, but I would also say the real meaning for oneself. And seeing this mandarin duck, and it helps a little but not much, a kind of footnote, that mandarin ducks are, male and female mandarin ducks are solicitous of each other's health. So it is particularly poignant to see a mandarin duck made single by the loss of its mate. Also a nice touch in the Japanese that there's not a distinction between whether it's the male or the female that has lost its mate. But those lines make so clear what is the function of literature to tie these two things together. Here is someone gripped with grief, torn by grief. God, I just remembered this. I met this Japanese poet this summer, Nanao Sakaki, and he did this wonderful thing. He read a series, or he actually recited from memory, a series of poems, starting Shiritoko Peninsula in northern Hokkaido and working his way all the way down to Okinawa. All the way down south he worked his way. And the only one I remember is the last one, which goes like this. Are you going? Are you going? I'm so sad, I can't breathe. Powerful. It's always good to get out of your own country for a while. I'd like to say a few things about natural history. In part because it's somewhat easier now to bring this subject up. Many people recognize that it's been an extraordinary evolution in American writing since the time of Teddy Roosevelt, writing about animals and national parks and forests and things like that. We've been through someone that many of you may have read when you were young, Ernst Thompson Seton, who was more interested in telling a crackerjack story about the outdoors than really saying much at all about the connection. This is not to be disrespectful, but I think for many writers of Ernst Thompson Seton's leaning or predilection or his era, were in a sense entertained by animals and by landscape. They weren't much interested in looking at the mystery that underlay anything. Basically, they preferred to believe that no such mystery was there. And then comes a generation, probably most significant writer of whom is Aldo Leopold, who said, yes, there is something there. And not only is something there, but there is something there for human beings to pay strict and close and well-informed attention to. Rachel Carson took a slightly different tack and said, what is going on out there is intimately tied not only to our psychologies, our frames of mind, but to the business of our business in the world. And then we have what's called, I guess, the environmental movement or the ecology movement, or I mean, there are lots of names for it. And I guess this movement in large part came out of the ability of scientists to start to tell us a little bit more than we had known in the past about how the physical world works and at what points we were imperiling our own future by being ignorant of the way in which it works. And of course, this also had a spiritual dimension. But all along, I think there have been writers who, it's unfortunate that I was about to say all of us, and I guess I will, we're all cast in the role of Thoreau, or John Burroughs, or John Muir. Those writers were antecedent. But I think what's going on today is something quite a bit different. And it's different because the ground against which this argument is being set is terrifically serious. It's not just entertaining salon conversation. We're talking about the whole ball of wax. We're talking about life and death. And I have been nervous, I guess, in discussing this because first of all, you always feel on the spot as a writer. Your world as a writer is the world of a listener and not the world of a talker. So as soon as somebody says, well, what do you think about this? You know, you jump to with some kind of answer just to keep yourself protected. And I haven't thought very carefully through this, and that's what I meant earlier this evening when I said that I wanted to share things, really, rather than try to be definitive or dogmatic, certainly not, about what writers do and what this issue is. And I think floating in here, and I'm going to try to get at some of it, is something about natural history that is different now than it has been in the past. I remember getting on an elevator one time in New York with a friend, and another guy was getting off the elevator. It was very confused, and people were pushing and shoving, and it was a crowded business day in the building and whatnot. And the man who was getting off the elevator, who was a friend of my friend, who was a German fellow, and my friend was trying to introduce me to him over somebody's shoulders and shopping bags and whatnot. It was a very confused scene. And he was looking for this shorthand way to make this connection in half in German and half in English. And what he said about a book of mine called Of Wolves and Men, to trigger the memory for the man, was he said, it's a book about tolerance. And we got on the elevator, and the elevator doors closed, and I felt a certain privacy, and I turned to him and I said, you know, I never would have thought of that. But I think that that's probably right. That what I was struggling with was to define tolerance. And then I thought about it from the first to the 30th floor, wherever we were going, and thought, I am interested in that a lot. I don't think it's a good idea for writers to take that tack. I think if you try to take these huge issues like truth and dignity and truth being, that's enough, and try to write about them, you're going to fail. But again, if you tell a good story, the truth might emerge, or this issue of dignity and some kind of clarification, or of prejudice or tolerance, those issues might emerge. And I think after a while you can look back as a writer in your own work and say, well, yes, this must be something that I'm concerned with. I seem to be writing about it all the time. So just noticing that in my own work made me think in conversations with other writers that what it is that this group of people writing about natural history, and I would think just at this end of the country, people like Gary Nabhan in Arizona, writing about the Sonoran Desert and the farming practices of Papago people, or N. Zwinger in Colorado, or Gretel Ehrlich, or David Quammen, or David Raines Wallace, or Robert Pyle. There are a lot of people today, roughly of my generation, writing about the relationship between human beings and landscape. And I think it's to miss the point of a lot of what's going on in this work to say that this is somehow part of a political movement or an environmental movement or something. I don't think what it's about. And let me say something that is speculative in the extreme, but was a help to me to understand what was going on, or help me try to define or provide an answer when I got in a corner, is probably the best way to say it, about what it is that writers like us are doing. Suddenly, now it seems all these anthologies are coming out with the works of these people, and everybody's trying to say, well, why is this kind of literature being written now? And I would, this is awkward to say because I sort of stand in the middle of it, but it has been the last few years, both at the National Book Award Ceremony and at the American Academy and Institute of Arts and Letters, this issue of literature in this kind of work has been underscored. And so I think it's legitimate to use the term with respect to some people's work. There's a writer named Eugene Linden, whom I have admired from a distance for a long time and finally had a chance to meet, whose most recent and perhaps best-known book was about the fate of the chimpanzees that were used in the language experiments. This is a horrible fate that was suffered by these animals. After they were taught to sign and to communicate, that's a hard word, I know, for some people, so I, if we could just leave it floating, to communicate with human beings. The research funds dried up. They were no longer in vogue, and so they were all shipped off. Many of them were shipped off to be infected with AIDS and cancer and to live out their lives in prisons of medical institutions, signing through the bars to people who had no idea what the animals were trying to do. The striking thing about Eugene Linden's work to me was that he not only exposed without rancor or without assignation of blame, but with the intent only to illuminate. That's how he wrote. And he also took himself to task as a journalist for failing to see early on in his work where this was going. So it's a work of courage. And when I met him in New York, we began talking about what is it that's going on in our generation of writers about the way we're writing about animals or landscape or things from many different points of view. What is it that's, there must be something turning over in the culture that this is going on now, because we're not all outdoorsmen and outdoorswomen. What is it that's here? Why is this metaphor serve us so perfectly now? And he suggested, he said, you know, this is a ballpark figure, but I would say that 80%, he says at dinner, of what I am reading in American fiction has to do with basic human relationships, those between men and women, issues of fidelity, fathers looking for their fathers, sons looking for their fathers, the relationships between daughters and their mothers. And he said, but basically these are the fundamental things. This is the stuff you ought to have pretty well straightened out by the time you're 30. Then you move on to the really important issues, the relationship between the individual and the state, the relationship between the individual and God. And those issues aren't turning up in American fiction. And then he says, but you know where they are turning up is in American nonfiction. And in his view, nonfiction writers in the past 15 or 20 years have begun to write about the subjects that have, in a sense, been abandoned by fiction writers. I suggest this not to create a polarity and to say, well, these people are bad and these people are good and these people are derelict and these people are our saviors. That's not what I mean at all. But it's just to look at this odd shift. And I, in my own world, I encounter so many people who really are talking about what to me are the fundamental issues of our time. One of which certainly is the relationship between the individual and the state. As anybody who watched those Contra hearings in Washington, I mean, that's the heart of the matter, or part of it. What is the relationship of these individuals outside the law and the state? What the hell is going on here? And this issue is not being, it's being addressed on a daily basis, perhaps in the newspapers or in an erudite essay or a well-written essay, rather, in the New Yorker or something. But it's not part of our day-to-day life. It's not turning up very often in novels and things like that. So Jean Linden said, you know, these issues are being taken up by nonfiction writers. The other anecdote that I want to pass along about this is that 2 years ago, I was at the University of Iowa, and they have an international writing workshop at the University of Iowa in which writers, most of them in their 40s and 50s, are invited from other countries all over the world to come and spend 3 months together and talk about writing and talking about the function of writing and its political dimensions mostly. And most of the writers who come to this workshop are well known in their own countries. Many of them are translated. Most of them are bi or tri or quadrilingual. And for the most part, their themes are political, overtly political. They're books like, Waiting for the Barbarians, Kotzia's book. And when we were having dinner, I felt quite out of place, frankly. I kept thinking to myself, well, you know, and really work, the large work that I've done is in nonfiction. Not in fiction. I'm not a poet. I'm not a novelist. And my subjects are the subjects of anthropology and natural history and geography and things like this. And so I felt a little bit out of place and was very touched by the invitation to join everyone. And during the course of the evening, something emerged that was very interesting to me. One thing that emerged was this man from Costa Rica said, oh, but don't you understand? You write about the same things we are writing about, but we write about it overtly. You are writing about it in a larger sense. And he said, you know, I think probably more people understand what the difficulties are by reading these kinds of things than by reading the overtly political novel. And what he was talking about is the day-to-day reality of one's relationship with the things that really matter, the family, the state, one's religious context or whatever. So that was one thing that came up. And the other was that he started this conversation and several other people picked it up. But he said, you know, I would expect it would be in America that we would begin to see the relationship between literature. And what he was saying was the classic way of defining the goals of literature from, say, a basis in European novels. The relationship between that kind of thinking and nonfiction. He said, we would expect it to come from America first. So I just offer those as thoughts about why natural history, and I speak of it in the broadest sense, not I'm not talking about stories about animals, I'm talking about a kind of writing that meditates, if you will, on the relationship between landscape and human beings, landscape and society, landscape and mind. I'm reading a quite extraordinary book now in preparation for going down, way down south. This is so strange, and I don't know if I'll have I don't know if I really have the courage to do it because the National Science Foundation is a very straight-laced group of people. But I am determined to bring a kite with me. I want to fly a kite at the South Pole because it's a way of reacting against the absurdity of getting on a C-130 and flying to the South Pole, which claimed the lives, the quest for which claimed the lives of so many people, and the way it's been set up, of course, in the literature, romantic literature of the early 20th century. I just love to fly a kite at the South Pole. In preparing for that trip, I've been reading an extraordinary book by Stephen Pine called The Ice, which I think is subtitled, A Journey to Antarctica. But it's really a meditation on Antarctica. It's a meditation on what he constantly calls the ice. And when I'm reading Stephen Pine, I'm reading somebody who's telling me a lot more than just the physics of ice. He's talking to me about intellectual history, and he's talking to me about the place of landscape in human plans. And of course, what's floating there, and I'm only about halfway through, but I know that somewhere before the book ends, he's going to bring up the business of the treaty. Antarctica, as you may know, is the only continent that's never known war. And the treaty is set up to preclude the existence of a military establishment on that continent. And it's up for renewal, or it can be renewed in 1991. So because of this worldwide search for natural resources, some of which can be found in Antarctica, and a certain belligerence, understandable on the part of smaller nations who have no claim in Antarctica, and for other reasons, this is getting, in 1991 is going to be pretty hot. 1991, as some of you may know, is also the year in which one of the, depending on your point of view, either one of the most benign or one of the most racist acts of the U.S. Congress, the Native Claims Settlement Act, will rear its ugly head in Alaska. It runs out at that time. Let me say some very specific things about natural history and the way in which it starts to turn over as something other than talking about animals. I can't remember this woman's name. She's a writer, lives in New Mexico. Bless me. I apologize to her. Her name just went right out of my mind. But I was reading a little piece of hers one day, and she was talking about quaking aspen, and she made the allusion to synaptic junctions. And I thought, oh, well, that's it, you know. If you ever tried to explain synaptic junctions in the mind and how they all fire simultaneously and in different directions, all you need to do is watch the wind move through a grove of quaking aspen. So seeing those kinds of things, those kinds of connections. That's the way natural history works, to help us, whether we're interested in trees or know the name of the quaking aspen, understand what's going on in our own minds. Another incident, I remember walking out of my house a year or so ago and seeing an orb weaver spider in the middle of this enormous web, and I was struck by the idea that this was protein out of her own body. And I thought, well, now, my God, this is an extension of the self, the like of which a human being has never known. It's to literally take something outside of yourself and build architecture with it and then pull it back into yourself. You know, that's such an extraordinary risk of turning yourself into something to ensnare your food. It was a marvelous thing to see. It's just a little trigger sitting there in this big leaf maple. One of the more moving moments of my life, which I go back to often, was a period of time that I spent in Northern California at Tule Lake, a national wildlife refuge there, watching snow geese. I never got tired of watching these geese fly. They're the most gregarious of all geese, and they're virtuoso flyers. I mean, you can watch flocks of 10,000 fly right through another flock of 10,000, and nobody bumps a wing, or at least it seemed to me in my binoculars that nobody ever did. And the more I watched them, and I did all the things that I was going to say I feel embarrassed about this, but I don't, because it's the way I work, and it's, but I would get up at, I got, they talk all the time. They're the most loquacious of all birds, as well as being the most gregarious. And I wasn't at that point allowed to stay in the refuge because what I really wanted to do was sleep with them. Not with them, of course, but sorry about that. I just sleep in the neighborhood, sleep in close proximity. So I finally got permission to do that, and then I got the answer to my question. But I did. I was getting up at 2 and 3 in the morning and going out and just sitting there in the reeds, waiting to see if they ever got quiet. And once in a while, they would. And there were quite a few birds there. They were at Tule Lake in November, this time of year. If you went to Tule Lake, there'd be 150, maybe 200,000 snow geese. And they're all together. They look like a cumulus cloud sitting on the water. They're extraordinary because there's so many. And when they take off, you know, they just lift off the water like a sheet of like a tablecloth coming up off a dark walnut table or something. The whole 10,000 or 50 or 80,000, however many are there at a moment, are all take off together. And when I would watch them and just sit there for hours and hours and hours, I was thinking about particle physics, and I was thinking about this marvelous ability that birds have to forget the self, it would seem, and become something else, become some other kind of animal, become an animal that is perfectly in tuned with something larger than the self. If you ever watch a small birds on a beach, if you're walking along with a dog, I think it was sanderlings or something like that. If you look at them, they'll all be pointed in different directions about their personal business. And then this thing, the dog, will come into their lives. And they'll all orient in the same way. They'll lift off the beach in this perfect marriage with a movement of air. They will move up into the wind. They will gain a certain altitude, and then they will glide off the wind. They will all turn, not at the same moment, which would be interesting, but at perfectly the different moment for each one, so that the movement is a perfect sine curve or a perfectly sinuous movement. It's not a military movement. It's this beautiful arc where the last one has to know what the first one, and the first has to know the last. So the thing is like an animal all into itself. But they'll move up into the wind like that, and then they'll come off it, and they'll glide down the beach. They'll all land, and then they'll all break up, and they'll all go about their individual business again. Now that's extraordinary, because that means that this creature that you call the bird is also part of something else that we don't have a name for except flock, which is lame. And I would watch these snow geese move, and I would wonder about family units. They're monogamous animals as well, which is another marvelous thing about them. They're very, very tight family units. And I would watch them become individual, and then family, and back into the individual, and then into the flock, all day long, for days. And I marveled at it because it presented clearly exactly the same problems that are presented in physics, in particle physics. I think any particle physicist who spent 10 minutes at Tule Lake watching snow geese would have a sense of speechless exhilaration at seeing played out on a macrocosmic scale the elements that constitute the ground against which his or her mind works to elucidate this interior of the atom. And this brings me to some fairly difficult material that I would like to mention in passing tonight, which is about chaos theory. I don't know if any of you have had a chance to see James Gleick's book, which has just come out, called Chaos, The Making of a New Science. I received the book in galleys over the summer. I read it. I was so physically excited about this book, I couldn't sit down. I would get up off the couch, I'd walk up and down in the living room, I'd go find Sandra wherever she had tried to get away from me, and read her sections of this book. She would nod. She said, I'll read it later on my own. But I pestered everybody about this book, and I kept saying to myself, this is extraordinary. This is an extraordinary book. Not because it's brilliantly written, it's well written, but the subject is absolutely mind-boggling. And, you know, so here I am as kind of a salesman for this, for the ideas, really more so than the book. But to try to put this in a capsule, chaos theory is something that has emerged since probably around the early 1960s. And if you could say in the broadest terms that our understanding of the relationship between space and time was Newtonian until Einstein's theories of general and special his theories of relativity, then that changed the way forever that we thought about the relationship between time and space and the observer as well. And then with quantum mechanics comes yet another change, a paradigmatic shift, a completely different way to understand things, out of which, of course, grew what in the arts is called modernism. The shifting of the relationship, a completely new understanding of what perspective was about and how things were related. And that was, you know, in the teens and the 20s. And there has been no comparable shift in our understanding of the relationship between time and space and the observer until now, which is something that's been growing since the early 60s and is now has this name, chaos theory, and now really has its first, what you would call secondary source, the first popular book that brings it into the minds of people like us. And when I was reading the book, I kept thinking of painters and sculptors and composers that I knew, as well as scientists, who would just, I knew, just do backflips when they read this book. And slowly, as other people in my world were, you know, became aware of the book, they would read it and they would call up and say, "My God, have you read this thing?" And I'd say, "Yes, I know." I would yak away. And so, a couple of weeks ago, when I was working up in Alaska, I had grabbed a paper on the way through Seattle, and I opened it and saw that that the book had been nominated for the National Book Award, which was. It pleased me a lot because it not only meant that I wasn't out of my mind, it meant that the book had found its way to a home. And I remember talking to some of the editors at Viking about the book because it's, as they say, a difficult book to sell. It's a difficult book to put a handle on. The only way they could talk about it was they would say, "Well, you know, it's like Gödel, Escher, and Bach, you know, like that book." So that's the way they would try to put a handle on it. But let me try to tell you very quickly about what's going on in chaos theory. What these people are talking about is that, I'm going to start to work very closely here with my notes. If I don't, I'll get confused. I'm too closely trained in the humanities. Not at ease with all of this other scientific material all the time. They have exposed, I guess you would say, this exquisite and delicate structure that underlies complexity. The most complex things that we can think about, these people are saying, can be seen to have a pattern underneath them. Think, for example, of water moving down a river, hitting a rock, and breaking up into this pattern of turbulence, of white water. This total confusion to the eye. What the chaos theoreticians are saying is that this is not random, and it's not chaotic. It has underlying it an exquisite and very delicate but perceptible order. If you were a mathematician, the way you would talk about this is that certain events can be described with linear equations. And when the situation becomes nonlinear, nonlinear equations are unsolvable. And those problems tend to get dropped. And in the history of mathematics, there are certain problems that just get dropped because they're insoluble. And then 100 years later or 50 years later or something, somebody comes along and says, "Oh, no, the way to see it is this way." And then you see it a different way and you can begin to work with it. And chaos theoreticians have made it possible to go back in a number of areas in physics and in mathematics and solve things that were not solvable because they were not comprehensible. They've made nonlinear realities approachable, better than saying solvable. There is a beautiful principle, which is the first thing that sucked me in like a vacuum cleaner when I hit this thing. This was, the words that are used are the sensitive dependence on initial conditions. And it's a discovery that things that seem elemental, so simple that they couldn't possibly be complex, are actually things that are extremely sensitive to an initial set of conditions. This principle was outlined in a marvelous paper called, I think, "Does the Flight of a Butterfly Over the Rainforests of the Amazon Affect the Structure of a Storm System Over the City of Dallas, Texas?" The answer in classical physics is, have you lost your mind? And the answer from chaos theoreticians of course it does. So you can see maybe the emerging what's so wonderful about this stuff. These chaos theoreticians are arguing against reductionism. I think reductionism in the sense that all things can be explained if you break them down into neurons and quarks and chromosomes. They're saying, no, better to look at something larger, a whole system. So they're taking us back from this, what to me is an extremely dangerous place, the reduction of things to elements, I think, somewhat unhealthy preoccupation with detail and the loss of an overall understanding. We complain about this in everyday language when we talk about the specialties in medicine or something like that. I mean, they're talking about a similar problem. I think you have to understand that what goes on in mathematics or what goes on in physics or what goes on in any of the sciences can be found in our day-to-day conversations to be an elucidation of exactly the problems we're talking about when we say, well, why are there so many specialist physicians and nobody can really tell you what's going on with your body, you know? So that, and then, of course, then we go to Japan and try to solve it that way. I think that chaos theoreticians have rediscovered certain things that are of value to us as readers and also of value in trying to see this business about this emergence of a concern or a fascination, a deep fascination with what is going on in the natural world. One is the discovery that it is not periodicity, not that is at the heart of everything, but aperiodicity. And I wrote this phrase at the top of this page, which was a translation for me, was the deeply erratic beat of the heart. And by that I meant that, not physical depth, but when you really get to the bottom of the beating of the human heart, it is found not to be rhythmic, but arrhythmic. Somebody who is a painter, actually, we were talking one day about word processors, and I have, I'm not going to mean to speak like a Luddite about it, but There is a kind of prose that is emerging that many people will tell you is prose composed on a word processor. It has a kind of gloss to it that is not present in writing before word processors came around. I think you could find the same thing. You find the same thing with the development of the typewriter. It's not to pick on one technology or another. It's simply to say, "Huh, something different is going on here. The technology is causing us to change slightly the syntax of the way we write." I know that I can tell it, and I knew that I wasn't crazy when I began to ask other people, say, do you notice this about, it's not good or bad, but do you notice how different the writing is, that is the word processor kind of writing? And they would say, yes, and then they would begin to define it and you talk about it. Well, this came up in conversation with a painter one time, a man whose work I had gotten to know, and felt comfortable talking to about this issue, which of course is delicate because, you know, I the last thing I want to do is say we shouldn't use word processors. That's not the issue. The issue is what is going on between us and the tools that we use to communicate. What is happening here? Is there something we should be aware of that presents a certain danger to us or not? You know, it's just keeping the questions open instead of closed. And he said, he turned to me, he's also a musician, he turned to me and he said, this has bothered me a lot about music. He said, people are now writing music in perfect measure. And what they're finding out is that the effect of this music on a human being is nothing at all like the effect of music that is played with basically imperfection. So another way to see this is that it is not periodicity that is at the heart of what we enjoy. It is something that is ever so slightly aperiodic, ever so slightly asymmetric, like the human face. You know, the human face is not a mirror image, both sides. The beauty of it resides in its slight arrhythmic structure. And that's one of the things in physics that these people are giving to us as, you know, to talk about in our everyday world. Another thing that they have brought to us is the world of fractals, which is, I guess the easiest way to talk about it is that these people are also saying, for example, that the average doesn't count. They're saying that there is no climate. There's no climate. Climate is the averaging of weather, but there is no such thing as the average weather. This doesn't exist. At the level of dimension, what they are saying is, yes, there is a first dimension, and it's two dimensions and three dimensions, but there are also dimensions in between. And one of the ways in which this was elucidated was in a famous set of experiments to measure the seacoast of England. And what they discovered, of course, was that depending on the level of refinement, the length of the seacoast of England eventually became, at the subatomic level, infinite. But what you had was a line of infinite length that could be contained within a finite box. Having discovered that, that was the door that opened to partial dimensions or fractional dimensions or fractals. So this area opened up where we had been content before to say only A or only B. These people were saying, no, 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 no. Don't deal with just the averages. Deal with what is really here. Don't reduce it to periodicity. Don't say this is basically what it is because it's not. Don't say that the butterfly flying over the Amazon basin has nothing at all to do with what's going on in Dallas. Perhaps indiscernible, but it does have a connection. And it serves, obviously, I mean, what emerges here, you can see it so clearly, is the material that flies in the face of totalitarian regimes and flies in the face of dogmatic statements of every stripe, which is why, of course, I get so excited about it, it's so beautiful. Another thing that they discovered is that disorder was channeled into patterns. And the thing that did this was this, they had this marvelous ability to come up with words like quarks. This one I'm not so sure about. Of course, I like it, but it's called a strange attractor, which sounds felonious. But disorder, they found, disorder in a system is channeled, and it's channeled by something called a strange attractor, which sets up a pattern in the disorder. Another thing, I guess, sort of in summation, or what they have made clear, is that in our world of day-to-day events, there are things that are simply too deep to be searched out by a computer. There are things that are intractable to analysis. And I think that this is one of the healthiest things that science has spoken about since the demise of Newtonian physics. There are things that are intractable to analysis. They cannot be got at. A scientist, one of these chaos scientists, said to James Gleick at one point, you know, to see this, you must restructure intuition. That means you have to come up with a new kind of common sense. It's such a marvelous idea that we have, you know, that common sense somehow stands as a bulwark against all of the tripe that runs through our lives. And what these guys are saying is, only if the intuition that you've got is changed periodically to match society's understanding of reality. The same common sense from the 17th century is not going to get you 5 feet down the road in the 21st century. But the whole idea of restructuring your intuition, it's kind of a formidable challenge. It's tough enough to think, let alone feel what's right and feel that you have to change that. Another thing one of these guys said was that you don't see something until you have the right metaphor to perceive it. You know, another wonderful thing out of these chaos theoreticians for us. So they've given us these things about rethinking reality, revitalizing, I guess, the quality of mystery without abandoning intelligence, not confusing mystery with ignorance. And they have brought us back to a deep contemplation, I think, of nature, particularly the river. When I'm reading manuscripts now and poems and things that come through my life, I'm struck by how often the river is returning as a structure within which people can utilize, a structure for people to utilize to talk about what is on their minds. And, you know, there's the Heraclitian business of never stepping in the same river twice, and that's part of why they use the river. But there are other reasons. The river is an extraordinary animal that has not been contained in some ways, like the tiger or the bushmaster or the katydid. People haven't been able to grapple with it. But it is this kind of thinking, I believe, that will make it possible for people to talk more eloquently in the future about this thing called the river. A friend of mine who is ill, I was trying to find a way to bring some kind of illumination and comfort. And I was thinking about some material Navajo people talk about changing woman. Changing woman among Navajo people. It's hard to make a one-for-one, but changing woman is sort of like the earth. She gave birth to what the Navajo call the twins, who rid the earth of monsters, but both the twins and changing woman are opposed to war, if you will. She's also in charge of female rain, light rain. And changing woman is associated with all of the plants, and basically, I think for Navajo people, is a reflection of what we would call change, but change in terms of evolution, growth, development. And at the heart of this is so presumptuous that I apologize for it, and ask to be allowed to simply go ahead and state it, because it's so rich, and you can take it with you and turn it over in your own mind. But, you know, Navajo language is incredibly complex. I think when you fancy yourself a master of language because you can speak French and German and Italian and Russian, my God, you know, to take on something like Navajo is a formidable task. I doubt that there are 10 non-Navajo people in the country that can speak the language fluently. For example, there are in Navajo 150,000 forms of the verb to go. Our verb to be, was, were, whatever. The states of being, their comparable verb is the verb to go. So mastering the language is extraordinarily difficult. But there is a phrase that is in Navajo that can be used in an attempt to sort of summarize Navajo theology or Navajo philosophy or an expression of the way the Navajo view the world. And there was this phrase that I finally found my way to when I was trying to write this letter to a friend to console, to offer solace. I try to read it here. It's very difficult. The phrase is Sa'a Nage'i Bike Hos Hon. A number of people, Gladys Reichardt among them, somebody you may know, have spent years trying to translate this phrase, and all admitting that it is imperfectly done. And probably the person who spent the most time trying to translate this phrase for us is a man named Gary Witherspoon, and he translates it as follows. Life constantly restored, according to which conditions all around are blessed or made beautiful. At the heart of Navajo philosophy is an understanding of harmony that informs this phrase. And what I was trying to say to my friend was that to focus on the constant restoration of life by which everything that surrounds us is seen to be or made beautiful or blessed. It is a state of coming into a kind of holy pattern, a perfect harmony that you never achieve, but your whole life you spend in pursuit of, trying to achieve this state of beauty. When the Navajo say go in beauty, that's what they have in mind, to go in this state. It kind of beats the hell out of have a nice day, you know. The past year, I've been traveling a great deal in Japan and Ecuador and England and in Southern Africa, in Namibia and Botswana, and in this terrible place called South Africa as well. My point of view and my antenna are probably no better than anyone else's, and I certainly don't stand up here to tell you that what I've seen is the only thing that's there. But I have noticed something that I want to share tonight. And it's something that I did not learn when I was in school and was somewhat surprised to find, and goes to me several light years beyond the tired truisms about the ugly American. And that is, everywhere I went, I had the feeling people were telling me that America was part of the past. And I had brooded myself about the relationship between the situation in the United States at the moment and the end of the British Empire. It doesn't take much to see the connections that are there. Perhaps they're superficial, perhaps they're very deep, I don't know. But I can't tell you how often I ran into this feeling that the United States was part of the past. And I thought it was very curious because Octavio Paz wrote an essay once about the inability of the United States to comprehend the reality of people in Mexico. And he said one of the problems is that Mexico is burdened by its past, It is a country that lives with respect to its past. And America is a country that lives with respect to the future. It is future-oriented. It does not pay much attention to the past at all. So I had that in my mind, and I thought, how curious. And of course, you're slightly wounded when someone says this, that your country is part of the past. I don't know what to say in answer to that, except another obvious observation, which is about the present administration. And I don't mean to be offering this as some kind of bashing of the people in Washington. It's simply, again, an observation, an attempt, I would hope, to transcend these issues of bipartisan or partisan politics. And that is that one of the most frequent criticisms that I hear of the current administration is that it is a group of people proclaiming a future that has already come and gone. And when I would hear people overseas say, your country is a part of the past, I would brood on it and I would think, why? Because certainly there are many things that we do that are reprehensible and I think morally indefensible. Things that we will not allow our children to touch with a 10-foot pole we ship by the ton to third world countries for their consumption. This alone is a despicable thing to not have been made public enough. But we also have, it seems to me, in comparison with other countries, a tremendous spirit of generosity, a tremendous courage, a tremendous ability to organize, and great reserves of energy. We have very valuable things to offer the world. But this thing about being part of the past, I would think, where does this come from? And I think one of the places that it comes from is that those countries who have not achieved the state, or the standard, if you will, I guess, of living that we have begun to see the price that is paid and have thought this standard of living is not only more expensive than any one country in the world can maintain, but it's ultimately detrimental. I would offer one observation here about where this became clear, and that is several years ago at an international meeting of women in Nairobi. It is to the everlasting discredit of the American press, the everlasting humiliating discredit of the institutions of the press in this country, that all we got out of it in the United States was what Nancy Reagan was wearing or what one of the other Reaganites or Reagan family members, the clothing that she was wearing. What's the daughter's name? I've forgotten. Maureen, right, thank you. It's amazing, current events, I just slipped away. This is what we got. We did not learn anything about what of a group of people who happened to be women, we didn't get anything of what they said. And what this group of people said to each other, women from China, women from India, from Europe, from Africa, from Costa Rica, from countries all over the world, what these people got together and said to each other was, let's talk about this business of the family. Let's talk about this business of war. Let's talk about this business of international trade and munitions. Let's talk about the health of our children. Let's talk about what kind of food we're eating, and let's talk about where the hell we're going to have clean water 40 years from now. Let's talk about deforestation. These weren't environmentalists. These were human beings. We didn't get a bloody word of it. It's not new. It's nothing new, really, to point this out. I think if you begin to travel outside North America, one of the things that you realize is that is in spite of the First Amendment, there is such a collusion between the First Amendment and the economic state that America is in that we simply don't know. This is the most, I think, poorly informed country in the free world. And the Russians know it, and people in Europe know it. And if you travel outside the states, you realize it. It's not that we don't want to think about all these things. It's that the proportions that are set up in American newspapers for us to take this much of this and this much of the other thing are based on an illusion about what is important to most people in the world. It's based on an illusion. Many of us know that, but we don't say it publicly often enough. And it became clear to me when I began talking to women who had been in this meeting in Nairobi that they were talking about the real things, the real important things for adults to be addressing themselves to. And they were just the things were never reported for two reasons. One is because it was women, and the second is because somebody thought, oh, this is environmentalists. These people are not environmentalists. I heard a month ago Jim Baker, who's the Secretary of the Treasury, I do know that, stand up before a group of people in Denver at the Fourth World Wilderness Congress, I guess, and speak about growth and the limits to growth and what he took to be environmentalism. I thought, well, at least this guy's a sophisticated politician. He's not going to say something to alienate this group of 1,000 people sitting here in this auditorium in Denver. But he not only said things that alienated them, he had no idea what the hell he was talking about. I turned to a man next to me whom I didn't know, and I said, you know, I don't believe this man has picked up a book in biology in 25 years. This is a person who thinks that clean water or something is a political issue. This is a person who has a misconception of biology, of public health, of all sorts of things. And there was this tepid applause when Baker walked off the stage, and I don't know if it ever registered in his mind that when he came to pay his respects on behalf of Ronald Reagan, that he did not know what he was talking about. He was talking about some kind of thing that was going to come that everybody... One of the things he said, which was, I have to repeat, I hope you find it as entertaining as I do. He said, if you're worried about having some kind of conservation ethic grow up or come to bear in the third world, the way to do it is to make a third world economy a first world economy, because it is only with first world economies that people have the leisure time to consider conservation issues. I hope this guy gets the irony when, fat with money, he's cut to the bone by some disease no one has a name for. But we do have something to offer in the United States. We are not obviously well represented by our politicians, and we're poorly represented, I think, as a group of people. Our virtues are poorly represented outside this nation. And one of the things that we have to offer is that we have made, in literature and in the other arts and in our day-to-day life, a fairly serious commitment to an elucidation of natural history. And by that I mean, what is the relationship between human beings and landscape? What is the relationship between imagination and landscape? What is the relationship between human emotion and landscape? What is this business that is 40,000, is probably longer than that, years old? It's not something that's new. It's something that's older than any of the systems we're living with today in our contemporary society. What is this business? We know a lot about it. And we can offer it. I think, I mentioned this book earlier, Stephen Pine's book, The Ice. And one of the things that he's doing in there is talking about intellectual movements and art movements and things like that and how they're related to landscape. And one of the most fascinating things that he says is that in the shift in literature, actually, I guess, from naturalism or realism or representational art at the end of the 19th century, the first part of the 20th century, to modernism, the landscape that should be most attractive to the modernist mind is Antarctica. But by the time the modernist mind comes along, the emphasis is on the interior world of the self and not the exterior world. So no one of a modernist bent ends up going to Antarctica. So he's talking about that. And I remember looking up from that paragraph and thinking to myself that this emphasis on natural history is in part must be a reaction against modernism. And this is what I meant about saying something radical, that I don't mean to be so radical as it is, just a thought about what kind of underpinning, what informs modernism in the arts, and what informs an interest in natural history. And I think the two are somewhat opposed, because a lot of modernism's strength and its power derives from a concern with the self, an inward-looking kind of thing, a concern with the painting itself as a physical object rather than what it represents, for example. And natural history says something quite different. It says the proper place to be focused is in the relationship between the self and what lies beyond the self, what is grander than the self, what is larger than the individual, which, for example, would be the vision of a nation or the vision of a family or the vision of a couple. And I certainly don't mean by this that, you know, that the analog for modernism should be a return to representational art as the only kind of valid art. But it would be interesting to see a return to representational art that was informed by mystery, in the same way these chaos theoreticians are saying, what the world is full of is mystery, and we must find some way as physicists, as scientists, to make our peace with mystery. And this is a way to do it. And this is what should be happening, I think, in the arts as well, to end this confusion between mystery and ignorance and say that there is something here that is profound, it informs human life, it fuels human desire, it is from this that we go out in our various ways, in our small and private and in our public worlds, to do the best that we can as individuals, as human beings, toward each other and toward other nations. It is out of this sense of the fundamental, the ungraspable mystery, the fear, the knowledge, the certain knowledge that you are not going to always be right, that other cultures have these words like isumatak or kotodama, or this expression, sa'anehi, bike, hozhon, other ways of knowing. We are not right always within our way, and these other cultures can inform us. I think that what I'm arguing for in some way, or in which I will close my remarks, is a return through using natural history as a kind of paradigm. Once again, it's the oldest metaphor that we have. It's the oldest structure we have in story to use to elucidate our interior world by making an exterior world to talk about, talking about what the animals did one day, or talking about the movement of rivers in esoteric or mundane terms. This use of the natural history metaphor is something that can help us to understand deeply rather than superficially what the importance of a community is. What is going on with those little sanderlings? What does this say about a community and the importance of the individual in the community? How does one integrate one's personal desire into the larger needs and desires of the family or of a country? How do you do that? Well, you can watch the sanderlings. And if you can really think, if you can really think, you could see a way to do it. That's why they tell those stories. All people tell those stories. I think also that I'm asking for a sense of exhilaration at the richness of life, at the divine textures that surround us. There's another Inuktitut word, kuvianikumut, which means to feel deeply happy, to feel a sense of happiness and joy and exhilaration all at once, and the expansiveness, the physical expansiveness of the body when you come in contact with something, someone you love, or at the movement of something that strikes you, or a ballet, whatever it happens to be, that makes you feel deeply happy, deeply joyful. A return of that to the center of human life, that this kind of thing is more important than having a bank account, and ultimately will take us a lot farther than a bank account will, to recover that sense in the world around us. And again, this is what I'm referring to, these chaos theoreticians. You could, I'm sure, move off into some other, in biology or some other science, and find a similar metaphor. But people are talking, it seems to me, many times about the same thing in their different disciplines. I think another thing that I would like to try to emphasize, and I don't mean disrespect here to be misunderstood, but there's a writer, a South African writer named Lawrence Vanderpost, who first years ago when I read his work made me aware of the way that the fundamentalist mind, the dogmatic mind, fights the idea of change, fights the idea of evolution. Basically, the fundamentalist mind is the enemy of time. It hates the movement of time. And this metaphor that I have said that I see emerging in a certain kind of writing about the river is a quintessential example of the beautiful movement of change in time, as is this Navajo idea, life constantly restored, constantly changing. There is no stasis. This idea, I think, is an important idea to keep in front of us. I mean all these ideas, too, to be considered when you go into a booth to place a vote behind a man or a woman's name. These are the real issues that we should be voting on. And if they cannot articulate those issues, then they're not people we're interested, we could say, in voting for. Of course, you have to vote for who is there. But so often they speak to the issues that are of no importance. they're not really important issues. They don't say what it is that we really want to know from them, which is, do they have any beautiful way of moving with change, for example? Do they have any grace in these kinds of things? Because if they don't, they're going to hurt us eventually. This reminds me of something a chaos theoretician said once about evolution. He said, evolution is chaos with feedback. Isn't that great? I think such a world that you know, to end here about what it means for writers is that it would take writers out of this position of being celebrities or entertainers or some other thing, which, in my view, we are not, and put them back where they belong, which is simply as another kind of people in service to a community. That's where writers belong. I'd like to end with two anecdotes about writing. When I was at Yale once, I was talking to some students about nonfiction writing, and they were young and idealistic and, I guess, sophomoric. And so they said, we're so well educated. Shouldn't it be our responsibility to go into a difficult situation, see what needs to be done, and write this out for people who don't understand because of the failures of American education how to solve the problem? I said, I don't think so. And instead of saying there's things that you could say so easily about, it's only when you leave the environment like that that you begin to understand how poorly prepared you are to think about what people are really in need of understanding. So you leave and you start all over again, or you continue your apprenticeship. But you have to be gentle in a situation like that because they have no way to understand anything different. And so I found another way to explain it to them, and I said, no, when you write about something that is difficult, if you're a political writer or an economic writer or an environmental writer or something like this, you go off and describe a problem, and you don't end up the piece by saying, this is what we ought to do. If you write about it clearly enough, people will understand what needs to be done. You don't need to tell them that. What you should think about instead is that the story should end on a different kind of note, and the note should be, this is what we've got. Is this what we want? It's better to do it that way. Because people who don't want it will arrive at a conclusion that's probably, possibly, better than yours about what to do. It's only necessary to recognize in a community that something is drastically wrong. It's not necessary for one person to say what needs to be done, the way to solve it. Because as soon as you open your mouth to say, as a journalist or anybody else, to say what should be done, you expose your own ignorance. There could be someone who chooses never to speak who knows a little better how to solve the problem. I realized, because I was forced to articulate it, how important that was to me, the sense that you're not there to tell people what to do. You're there to help describe what is going on. I go someplace, the Arctic or Antarctica or Japan or something, and I say, basically, when I came to this place, this is what I saw. And if it should be that something is awful there, I could say in some way, this is what we have. Is this what we want? Which is partly what I was trying to do in South Africa. And we'll go back again to try to do. The second anecdote is to end on this note about this evolution in physics and mathematics having to do with chaos, is that one of the ways that you end up as a writer defending yourself, especially when your work becomes public, against intrusion, because you're as fragile as any other human being, you're as wrong as any other human being, and yet in public you can be put in the position of having to say everything that's correct, or having to have, supposed to have wisdom about the things that you do, or be able to say why it is that you write, or why is this, or why is the other thing. And most of us don't know. And most of us are perplexed about what to do about our celebrity and our standing, and it becomes very confusing, and in the end it can become very destructive. And so what you do is you develop a kind of shorthand, and people will say, well, what do you do as a writer? And one of my shorthand answers used to be that, which is, you know, such a silly thing, but that's why it's a good shorthand answer, is to say that what you do is bring order out of chaos. And I used to say that all the time because I thought my notes, the different people that you interview, all the traveling and the moving around and those chaotic materials and reading dozens and more than dozens of scientific papers and other people's books, and there's a tremendous chaos, a chaotic pieces of information all over the place. And out of all of this chaos, you bring a kind of order. It's easy to see that somebody who loves cathedral architecture as much as I do would be perfectly understandable that this kind of person would choose to say, well, you bring order out of chaos, you know. But when I finished that book, I thought to myself, that's not what writers do. What they do is bring chaos out of order. They bring the chaos out of order. And what I mean by that is that you infuse the material with beauty. You infuse what you present as the best story that you can tell. You infuse it with a divine pattern, and you leave it to the reader. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Literary Arts, the Archive Project. That was writer Barry Lopez. He spoke at Portland Arts and Lectures in 1992. Lopez is an iconic Oregon writer of over a dozen books. Thanks for joining us for the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from the first 30 years of literary arts in Portland. And we have lots of other talks on our website, and you can listen to them all at literary-arts.org. The Archive Project is a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting, produced by Spencer Raymond. I'm Andrew Proctor. Thanks for joining us.